number 72091, James Cooper versus State. Ms. Dickinson for the defense, for the appellant. Mr. Rolls? Rolls. Mr. Rolls for the state. We'll be at ease while Ms. Dickinson sets up and Mr. Rolls sets up. Ms. Dickinson, do you want to save some time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to save 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd also like to introduce the court to one of the trial attorneys. Mr. Iacker is here, Kenton Iacker.
How do you do? Welcome to the Supreme Court.
May it please the court, my name is Sharon Dickinson and I represent James Cooper. We presented several different issues to this court, but I'd like to start with the Batson issue. In this case, during the jury selection, the state used two of five peremptory challenges to remove two of the only three African-American prospective jurors on the panel. When this occurred, James made a Batson objection, pointed out that two of the three had been removed. And he said, I can't see any reason why they would want to exclude them. He asked the state provide a reason. The state said, we don't have to. You didn't make a prima facie case of discrimination. The trial court agreed and asked James to elaborate. James repeated his same reason, but added, both of these jurors testified they could be fair and weigh the evidence fairly. Both were questioned further by each side and found to be fair. So at this point, given the pattern, I'd like to make a Batson challenge. Well, the court acknowledged that James' argument was based on the percentage of jurors removed, but said, I can find reasons why the state would want to remove them, denied the challenge. So we never got past step one. And this is error. And we know this because of the United States Supreme Court case of Johnson versus California, which explains that the standard for establishing a prima facie case under step one of a Batson challenge is not a high one. It merely requires a defendant point to evidence raising an inference discrimination occurred. In the Johnson case, under those facts, it found sufficient reason to conclude that the defendant had made a prima facie case based on the removal of two and then all African-American jurors. The Johnson case gives this court guidance because it says the Batson framework was designed to conduct all three steps before making a decision on discriminatory intent. Johnson court added, rather than engaging in needless speculation after the defendant makes a Batson challenge, court could simply direct the prosecutor to respond. The complete three-step process supports the constitutional interest Batson was designed to protect. The overriding interest in eradicating discrimination from our civic institutions, which suffers whenever an individual is excluded from making a significant contribution to governance on account of their race. Well, this court said something similar to this also in Watson. In Watson, this court gave us examples as to what could be an inference. And one of the things I said is a pattern. And that's exactly what James Cooper argued, a pattern, or other evidence. Watson discussed general and racial discrimination, and it looked at the percentages of people who were a minority in the panel and the percentage of peremptory challenges being used to exclude them. Well, if you do that in this case, what you find out is that with three African-American minorities in the panel, a 23-person panel, this means only 13.04% of the panel was African American. Then using the same comparison as in Watson shows that the state used either 50% or 40% of its peremptory challenges to remove a minority that was only 13.04% on the panel. Thus, there was an inference of discrimination shown, as James contended when he said they removed two of three, there is a pattern. Now, we also pointed out several Ninth Circuit cases that would suggest the removal of such a high percentage on the panel shows an inference, and that's Ferdinand versus Rose, Shirley versus Yate, and there's some others. State didn't respond to those cases, so I would submit they're precluded from arguing about them now. But the next
jury selection process, were any non-minorities removed before the two African Americans were removed? You know what I mean? In other
words, before the peremptory challenges?
Yeah, for any cause or for preparatory challenges. In other words, was what? Tell me what happened during this process.
Okay. I do believe there may have been someone removed prior to that. I don't recall exactly. However, when you're doing a Batson challenge, you only look at the panel that is there where they're going to do a peremptory challenge. I believe that what happened is that the state did try to do a for-cause challenge on one or both of these. But the point remains that under Batson, you just look at those that are in the jury box, so to speak, and you're using your peremptory challenges. The next question is what standard of review would this court use? I know in the Reimer case, the court used clear error. And in fact, James argued that initially. But after you look at the United States Supreme Court Johnson case, I suggest to you that under step one of a Batson challenge, the standard is de novo, which means that all you're doing is looking to see what occurred, and you're making the decision yourself. The reason why de novo would be more appropriate than clear error is because in step one, the court was not weighing facts. She was simply making a decision, or he, simply making a decision on whether or not the defense had presented sufficient evidence. Moving along to the facts of this case and the insufficiency of the evidence and double jeopardy and unit of prosecution, if there is no more any questions about Batson, and I'll move on to these other issues.
I just wonder, what was the judge thinking about? I know that we've written some stuff in some of our Batson cases that seem to indicate maybe you have to call the jury commissioner in, or you have to do some kind of study in the Las Vegas community, Clark County community, as to how jurors are picked, which seems onerous on defense counsel. What was the judge thinking when, or I shouldn't say thinking, but what did the judge state as far as inability to prove step one?
She just said it was insufficient. With regard to your question about the jury commissioner, that would be if there was a challenge to the veneer, which we did not make in this case. We made a challenge to the use of the peremptory challenges. She did not state what her reasons are, but I don't believe that the court can decide on her own what her reasons are and then make a decision. She has to let the prosecutor make a statement and then balance it and decide, and she just didn't do that.
And there were 23 in the panel total?
Correct.
So I wonder what the ruling would have been if all three had been challenged as opposed to if only one had been challenged. I mean, that's why we have step two and step three, for that exact reason.
Correct. And I think the Johnson case suggests that the trial court should always go through all three steps. I mean, the court can go through all three steps and then say, well, I don't know about step one. But that didn't happen.
Well, I think some of our dicta, I can understand the district attorney when they read a 30-page plus decision and Batson's the big issue, and there's dicta in there about how you prove or how you should prove step one, whereas Johnson, I think, controls, you know, as to how you prove step one. But I'd be interested to see Ms. Rolls talk about one versus three. If one had been challenged in a preemptory challenge versus three being challenged in a preemptory challenge.
Ms. Westbrook, which standard of review are you? I'm sorry, Ms. Westbrook. Ms. Dickinson, I'm sorry. Which standard of review do you think this court should apply to step one?
On step one, de novo.
And you recognize we haven't. You raised that in your reply brief.
Correct.
So I haven't heard from the state on that, but that's your position because that's an unsettled area as far as.
After I reread Johnson, I came back and changed it and said I think it's de novo.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. With regard to the facts of this case, James was convicted of child abuse and neglect under a theory, at least one of the theories was that the children saw him hit the mother. And under issue one, I argue that is insufficient to state a crime. As to child abuse, a spectator cannot be a victim. They have to actually be subjected to something are subjected to harmful behavior. In this case.
Well, okay, I just want to ask you, where are you though on that? Are you saying it has to always be physical harm?
I believe the statute allows physical or mental harm.
Correct. Why wouldn't that be mental harm? You have to explain that to me.
In my opinion, when I look at mental harm and physical harm, I think about the Reimer case where there was a pattern of abuse going on almost daily, and the state pled that, and the court substantiated it. But also require the state to bring in experts to say they examined the children, that there was some mental harm. Here the kids don't even remember it. They were given to the mother the next day. CPS did
Thank
nothing.
You.
My time's just about up. I just want to explain that a lot of the facts are not in dispute. James Cooper called 911 first. He asked the police get there. He wanted medical attention. And Brittany Jensen ultimately said, you know, he didn't start this. He was just defending himself. If the court has no other questions, I'll reserve my time.
You have about 4 minutes and 20 seconds.
On all the issues. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Willis.
Counsel, if it pleases the court, my name is William Rolls and I represent the respondent in this matter. If there are no specific questions right off the bat, I would like to address the Batson issue first before proceeding on.
Can I just, within the Batson, can you address what was the propriety or the relevance of asking the jurors about the Black Lives Matter movement?
And Your Honor,
relates to this?
Justice Stiglitz, I think it's important to address topics that at the time when we're selecting a jury that are hot button issues within the community. I don't see it as any different as if I were to select a jury today and discuss the recent Supreme Court nomination. And one of the reasons why I believe that it's important is because when you ask a juror straight up if they can be fair, 9 times out of 10, if not 99 out of 100 times, a juror is going to respond to that question with a judge in front of them in a courtroom setting that, yes, they can be fair. It's not until you discuss these types of issues that are relevant in the community that you could really get into the person's opinion on the matter. And I think that is phrased out in this situation here because when we discussed the matter with juror number 274, I believe she indicated she could be fair. But then, as a result of the questioning with regards to Black Lives Matters, we got more and more into what she believed the trial was about, more and more into what she believed the defendant had done at the situation, because I believe her exact wording was, most of these cases result in a plea bargain. So if the defendant in this courtroom setting is willing to take this to trial, there has to be another side to the story, or he has to be innocent.
But what does that have to do with Black Lives Matter? Yeah, so because I just want to, this is not a police shooting case. In fact, police don't really even figure prominently into this case at all. So something that may have be hot button in the community on a different topic, I don't see what you just said about most cases resolving plea bargains has anything to do with Black Lives Matter.
Yes. The reasoning for that line of questioning, and I apologize, is that when you discuss these issues here, you're more able to get into a person's actual beliefs on certain subjects within the trial process itself. Because as I mentioned previously, if I were to ask an individual, can you be fair? They are going to say yes. Can you be impartial to both sides? They are going to say yes. But when you discuss relevant issues, relevant questions, similar to the line of reasoning that the state had with regards to its domestic violence line of questionings here, when you bring those topics in and you explore them with the persons, you can really get into their actual beliefs and opinions. I don't think, with regards to it being specific to this case, as you mentioned, there's no police shooting, but it's more of a tool to get a person to talk and to get a person to open up to discuss their beliefs instead of asking point blank questions if they can be fair, because everyone's going to respond yes.
How many people were knocked off because of their answers to Black Lives Matter?
I believe she was the only one who had answered in a way in which that we were concerned with, and it's not because of her affiliation with Black Lives Matter. I believe the record's clear that she wasn't a member or believed in it, but had understood the movement. And it's really the line of reasoning with regards to the questioning of why a defendant is here on the stage. It'd be no different than if a juror got up and said, if the state didn't offer a plea bargain, this case must have been great. And
I'm having trouble with the tie-in with Black Lives Matter, any more than if you had asked the jury in that instance, what do you think about Me Too? The Me Too movement, because that's prominent. And then they say, well, I think if there's plea bargains, I'm just having trouble tying those two up, except as it would relate to trying to elicit some sort of bias in African-American jurors.
I agree with you, Justice Stiglitz, that it is similar to a Me Too type situation question here, but that was what was relevant at the time of the community. At that stage when we tried this case back in 2016, I don't believe the Me Too movement was as prominent as it would be. But
what bias were you trying to uncover by asking about Black Lives Matter?
Bias with regards to either side of the parties here. It's not more so the specific topic of the question itself. It's just more so to be able to delve into issues to get people to open up and to talk.
And so did that demonstrate a bias any more than when people get up and say, well, if they're here, they probably did something? I mean, which is a pretty common belief among jurors that they're not educated about it.
It is. But then as I've learned and as I think as it developed in this particular record here, when you get individuals to open up and when you get individuals to start talking about relevant hot topics in the community, you can start to get really into their opinions on the matters and stuff along those lines. And that's what the state's, I think, reasoning is, and with asking questions related to relevant hot topic issues in the community. I believe, Justice Chair, you might have had a question.
Well, I just don't understand that when there's three African Americans and two out of three get knocked off, that there's no... that you can't get past step one. I just don't understand that. I don't know anything that we've talked about in our conferences or in our writings that would say that you can do that. You can knock off two out of three, and that's it. The defense hasn't proven anything as far as going to step two and step three.
If I may address that, Justice.
Sure.
And one of the things I'd like to bring this to this court's attention here is the reasoning in Watson here. I don't believe Watson suggests that statistics alone are 100% always sufficient here. Even in Batson here, you must prove step one. And statistics are one way to suggest that a pattern of discrimination has happened here, or one way to prove step one. But Watson itself, relying on opinions out of Washington, has rejected a bright line rule, has rejected a magic number rule, where if you strike a number of people from a protected class, that automatically proves discrimination here. I think the...
Well, it automatically proves step one, though. I mean... That's why they have step two and step three. It's not like it's a winner just because you go to step two and step three. You're not a winner automatically. I mean, you've got to survive one, two, and three. But two out of three African Americans in 23 veneer. I don't know. That's why I said, what if it was three and what if it was one?
And Your Honor, my reading of Watson suggests that there is no bright line magic number rule, that you have to take into consideration a number of the other facts and circumstances going on that the district court was able to observe, that the district court was able to ask questions with the panel, that the district court heard the answers, that the district court saw the conduct of the specific prosecutors that were conducting the voir dire. And so Watson itself, relying on Washington cases, says that there's no magic number. And I think that's what the district court did in this situation here, was that it saw the parties conduct this voir dire. It saw the conduct of the specific prosecutors. It saw their questions. It saw their answers. And based on its determination, which is also similar to how I believe that it should not be a legal question for the standard review, because it's a question of fact, did not feel that striking two members of the protected class automatically made this a step one or satisfied step one because of all the other circumstances that she saw.
What would the defense need to do? What would satisfy the district attorney's offices to satisfying step one? What do you want them to do?
And I believe it would be a case-by-case basis, but I believe the district court in this situation here wanted a little bit more. They wanted something along the lines of the types of questions the district attorney asked to those specific members of the protected group, the amount of time that the district attorney spent with those members, the fact that they spent significant amount of time with them, didn't even address issues with regards to other members of the community. I think that's what the district court was wanting to see, other than a purely statistical argument. Because, Justice Terry, if we get in a situation in which maybe there are only two members of the protected group on this panel here, and we use one of our peremptories to remove one of them here, that would automatically give us 50%. Statistics themselves on this sample size are meaningless because the removal of one member of a protected group, if it constituted 50% of that protected group, does not automatically prove discrimination outside something else. And I think that's what the Washington case discusses in a situation here, is that numbers can be sufficient. But Watson itself also addresses other factors that this court or the lower court can take into consideration. And I believe that's what the district court wanted here. They gave the defendant, Mr. Cooper, ample opportunity to provide more because based on what she had seen in the voir dire, the questions asked, the conduct of the prosecutors, that the statistical argument alone was not sufficient. She wanted a little bit more with regards to what Watson says, that there are other ways to prove it as well and other factors to take consideration, and she provided them with the opportunity to do that, and they were unable to do it other than a statistical argument here.
Who is the trial judge?
Judge Walsh, Your Honor.
Sorry?
Judge Walsh. Jesse Walsh.
I just want to go back to that, because hey, it's not statistics alone. What's the race-neutral relevance of asking about Black Lives Matter?
And I think Justice Stiglitz, with all due respect, is getting caught up on the actual movement at the time. Because say, for instance, we were going on with this specific situation, I think the most recent hot topic issue would have been the nomination of Justice Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court here. If we were in 2018 and picking a jury, we would talk about those types of opinions, because talking about hot topic issues allows people to open up other than just giving specific direct answers.
Is there an event case that mentions the word hot topic in hot topic issues?
It's just my words at this particular time in terms of the voir dire. I'm using the hot topic thing.
But I think that the Clark County District Attorney's Office keeps on knocking off African-American jurors. Someday the legislature is going to say no more. They're going to let us as judges pick the juries like they do in federal court. So I'm just a warning that, because 12 years on this bench as a Supreme Court justice, I don't understand why it's so important that there be a majority, a tremendous majority, or overwhelming majority of white jurors in criminal cases. I don't understand what the fear is of African-Americans serving in this community.
And, Justice Chair, I do disagree with you with all due respect with regards to the practices of the Clark County District Attorney.
Well, I've seen it for 48 years.
I understand.
48 years of being a criminal defense attorney, a district court judge where I didn't allow it as a district court judge, and a Supreme Court justice where I've written some opinions that have reversed much worse cases than this would ever be as far as the criminal activity. So I just want to be straight. This is one of my last times for oral argument, and I think it needs to be said to the Clark County District Attorney's Office. It's going to happen someday. You can't keep on knocking off so that an African-American or anybody appears in court as the only black person in the room, unless there's happens to be a black defense attorney or prosecutor or a black judge.
Your Honor, I understand your position, but I do, with all due respect, disagree as to other practices. And certainly that did not happen in this situation here. And I think Judge Walsh's conduct and her determinations down below suggested the fact that she did not see any specific conduct on behalf of the prosecutors in this case to even warrant going to the next level.
Well, I think she's misread our cases on Batson. I think she terribly misread those cases. And she was a good friend of mine before she retired from the bench, a good, good friend. But I think she just misread what we've said in our Batson cases. She's misread it. I think that they were the, I don't know what more a defense attorney could have done, except two out of three are gone. I'm sorry. Justice Sigrist, go ahead.
Mr. Rawls, yes. I want to talk about just what the judge did with response to that. So we have the prima question about whether there's a prima facie. And then the judge makes her statement about, she's like, I could think of some reasons, you know, why or whatever. Why isn't that a Brass situation?
Well, I think this issue in Brass, Your Honor, is that no hearing at all was conducted. Mm-hmm. The issue in Brass was that the judge down below excused the juror before I believe we even got into the step one analysis here. I think that's distinguishable from this case is because Judge Walsh did conduct the step one analysis and she did not believe that a statistical argument alone was sufficient. And so when the judge made the comment with regards to the reasons she can think, I think it goes into the fact that, as Watson suggests, that there are other factors to consider. She saw the conduct of the parties, she saw the questions asked, she saw the responses, and she saw the conduct of the specific prosecutors. Because I think when you look at Batson itself, it's sort of a subjective view of the prosecutors who themselves are in that courtroom right then and there. Myself, Ms. Rhodes, she saw our conduct, she saw the questions we asked, she saw how we displayed ourselves in that things, and based on the line of questioning, she did not feel that statistics was alone. And so I think it's distinguishable from Brass in that sense and goes to suggest that the step one analysis is a factual question because it requires a judge to determine whether specific conduct in that case rises to the level of whether a statistical argument alone is sufficient.
Thank you.
Justice Sherry, if I may just briefly address the statistics, I can see how, and I agree with the defense that the cases that they've cited to with regards to the numbers would suggest, based on prior case law, that that was enough at this time here. But I think if you look at the ultimate numbers and the underlying numbers of this case, what we had was a situation in which there were 23 members of the panel. There were three African-Americans on the panel, which constituted 13%. Now, I don't think it's improper for me to suggest that 13% is close to 10%. When we finished with the panel, the members who were selected, we were at 8% of the African-American members of the panel. And I don't think it's improper for me to suggest that 8% is close to 10%. So if we get caught up with the weeds, which is why I think the statistical arguments alone should not be the controlling factor and there should be no magical case number, what we were left with is roughly 10, what we started with was roughly 10% of African-Americans, and what we ended with was roughly 10% of African-Americans. And I think that alone right there, it does not show, at least with regards to clear error, that the court violated the first step of the Batson challenge based on the statistical argument, which I think is also in line with the number of African-Americans within the Las Vegas community. I see I have a minute left, and I would really like to address the unit of prosecution if there are any specific questions. And I understand that we did not respond to this in our respondents' brief specifically, and I apologize for that. But the issue that this court had in Castaneda, the issue that this court had in Wilson, and I believe in other case laws at Shubi State, was the simultaneous possession of multiple images and the fact that the state was unable to prove distinct, separate downloads at that particular time. And so the issue in Castaneda was we weren't able to prove whether he downloaded all 15 images at once or he just simultaneously possessed all 15 images at once. In Shubi State, it was similar. It was an ongoing camera recording, and we were unable to prove whether they were separate, distinct cameras here. That's different. I agree with the word any being ambiguous based on case law provided by the Supreme Court, but the use of force or violence, which is the unit of prosecution, is not the same concern with regards to simultaneous possession of a number of images. It's more closely related to Vergara-Martinez, where the state pled specific facts, distinct violent conduct. I see that my time up. There's no specific questions. I'll submit the matter to your court's discretion.
Thank you. If I may, I've just got a... And I know you didn't have an opportunity to really address this because it was raised in the reply brief on the standard for to use in evaluating it.
With regards to step one?
Yes.
Yes.
I think that's a great question, Justice Paraguay, or Paraguay, excuse me, Your Honor.
I answered anything.
I don't think it's a purely legal question with regards to step one because it requires factual determination. Statistics alone should not be sufficient to satisfy step one. It requires looking at the conduct of the voir dire. It requires looking at the specific conduct of the prosecutors that are handling the voir dire. It requires factual determinations that you cannot pick up from a cold record. It requires factual determinations of seeing the conduct of the members of the panel, their body language, that are not picked up on a transcript. And so I think when we're discussing whether a court has erred with regards to step one, especially with regards to whether the statistics are alone or not sufficient, that it's a factual determination and it's got to be clear error because I don't believe it's a legal question because of the number of facts that are required to review whether the defendant has met their first burden.
But, sir, then don't we need the judge to make findings so we can understand what the judge sees? In terms of, you know, I appreciate what you're saying about a cold record. You haven't been in a courtroom, you know, that wouldn't the judge, that be the judge's obligation to say, I don't think you've made a prima facie. I've seen the witnesses. I've seen X, Y, and Z. I mean, wouldn't that give us something to review?
I would agree with you that would give something to review. I think Judge Walsh down there did this in this situation when she gave Mr. Cooper ample opportunity to explain certain things over and over and over again because she was not buying a statistical argument. And she even suggested that she can think of a number of reasons as to why the state would have used their preemptory. So although I don't think the record may have been the best record, excuse me, that this court likes to see, I think there is a sufficient record to determine that Judge Walsh, based on the conduct of the prosecutors, did not find the mere kicking of two of members of a protected class to be sufficient to satisfy step one.
Do you wish now, Judge Early, to let you speak for yourself and give us step two from which we could understand what you're saying?
Judge Walsh,
I'm sorry.
And no, Your Honor, I believe that the analysis that we have in this situation, and I know it's a little conflicting with regards to the Supreme Court law, because I think Hernandez v. New York says once we offer step two, step one is moot. And if they can't satisfy step one, I don't think it's the responsibility of the state to provide race-neutral reasons, because it starts going down a rabbit hole where if you kick one member of a protected class, we have to start giving race-neutral reasons when there's been no pattern of discrimination.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Dickinson. Round it up to 5 minutes, please. Give you a full five.
You know, striking one juror for an inappropriate reason, such as racial discrimination, is sufficient. We see that United States versus Lorenzo, United States versus Vasquez versus Lopez. So striking two and showing a pattern, I think, is sufficient to show an inference that there is a possible problem here with the way the peremptory challenges are being used. Now, I understand Watson different than the prosecutor. I don't understand, like, you have to go through all five or six suggestions. I think one can be enough. And that's what we did. We did one with the pattern and the statistics. And I think that's sufficient to get us to step two. And I think, as the court realized, it doesn't necessarily mean we're going to win on step three, because there's more argument and more issues raised with regard to the Batson challenge, but we didn't get there in this case.
Is there any Nevada cases that talk about not being able to prove step one? Is there anything that we've got? I don't think we've ruled on that yet.
I don't think you have. I don't think you've ruled on step one.
I understand where the prosecutor's coming from, though. Even though it was tough on him, I understand, and he did a good job of defending what he did. Good defense attorney, maybe someday. But when you discuss Batson with a bunch of defense attorneys, like, what are some of the other ways you could have done this besides pattern? What could you have done?
I think what he was suggesting was to discuss some of the questions that were asked and to discuss maybe the way he interacted with the different jurors. But I don't think that is required. It may be required if you only have one that's being removed, but when you have two being removed and you have this statistical issue, I think that they're required. I don't think we needed to present anything more. I think it was sufficient. And I think this is very similar to Brass. The court had made up her mind on step one, and we weren't going any further. Now, I understand in Brass, they have the hearing afterwards. But here, we really didn't have a hearing because the court had made up her mind without hearing anything else. So for that reason alone, I would ask that you reverse his James' convictions. But there's other reasons to go ahead and reverse and perhaps dismiss his conviction, and that's the insufficiency of the evidence and the unit of prosecution test, because the evidence was simply insufficient to find him guilty of the child abuse, as I outlined under issue one. And with regard to the battery domestic violence, he ended up being convicted of two battery domestic violence.
Those were clearly alleged and based on two separate acts. You had the battery and you had a strangulation, two distinct acts. The fact that the jury on the strangulation found that to be a lesser, how does that create a double jeopardy issue or a unit of prosecution issue?
Under the battery statute, it does not say that you should be convicted of each and every hit or stomp or touching.
But you could. They could allege you punched her and you kicked her, and those could be two separate offenses.
Well, I realize they cite Martinez-Varga, I think, but that was two different statutes. Here we have the same statute.
But even under the same statute, if you punch me in the face five separate times, if they wanted, why couldn't that be five separate counts?
Well, that would require this court to interpret the misdemeanor battery statute to include every hit, every punch. And the court hasn't done that so far.
That's an issue of discretion in charging. I mean, but that's a separate. You're telling me it's the same to me if I get punched in the face five times as one time?
Well, my understanding, the reason they charged those two separately is because there were two different statutes. And so they were allowed to charge the strangulation separate from the other acts. But The jury did not come back with strangulation. They just came back with the misdemeanor, the battery DV, which was the same as the first. So the legislature allowed the prosecutors to charge these both separate, but the legislature has not said that every hit or punch in the regular battery case is a different battery.
Well, they haven't said they're not either. I mean, why can't they charge for multiple different acts of conduct? Even though they may, multiple punches, why couldn't they charge multiple batteries?
When you read the statute, it says any willful and unlawful use of force or violence upon the person of another. That's what they've defined a battery to be. They've not changed this since 1971. It's housed in the area of crime against a person. There's no legislative history to explain that it's other than one course in conduct. If the legislature wanted to have it more than a course in conduct, then they would have said that. They've never changed it. The only time I remember them discussing it is in the Hobbs case, and they discussed spitting, whether spitting could be a battery. And they said, we're using the common law definition of battery and the meaning of force in Black's Dictionary, and they looked at power, violence, or pressure. But even there, they didn't say that every time you spit at someone, it's a separate battery. So I would suggest the legislative history says that it's a course in conduct.
Thank you. Court, thanks both counsel for your arguments. And I really appreciated both sides in this. I think that both of you did an excellent job of presenting, especially the Bats and the Chiefs, as well as Ms. Dickinson. And this matter will stand submitted.